Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking with Rennie Gower. Welcome, Rennie, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. I'm going to sort of zip through this, but I just want people to have some sense of your background and of your accomplishments, which are pretty impressive. Rennie has over 25 years of professional experience in the fine arts. Her work has been showcased internationally in Peru, Korea, Israel, Belgium, England, Moldova. Where is that?
Russia.
Oh, okay.
I guess it's still Russia.
It's still Russia. And Moscow. We know where that is. Additional national venues include, and this is a limited list, folks, McLean Project for the Arts, Erie Museum of Art, Villa Terrace Decorative Art Museum, Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, and the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And you've also received numerous grants and awards. And again, I'm only going to mention a few of these because the list is kind of long. An NEA, SECA, which is a Southeastern Artist Fellowship, one from the Virginia Commission for the Arts Project Grant. And I think most recently, you're recognized by the Southeastern College of Arts Conference with a 2007 Award of Excellence in Teaching. Congratulations.
Yes. Well, thank you. I was very honored to have received that
recognition. Why would someone get that? What have you...
Well, you're nominated by someone, a peer. And
oh, it is peer nominated.
It's competitive, and the organization votes on it.
And uh-huh.
Deems whether you've done significant teaching or not.
Right. So. No, it's a curious thing because teaching is such a... happens in, you know, in these rooms where nobody's usually watching, and so...
Well, you have to put together a promotional packet.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha. That makes sense to me now. Okay. Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, let's talk a little bit about your work.
I can try and describe it, and I look at textiles for inspiration a lot, but it's always been about painting and paint on different materials, mixed media, but primarily canvas or some other found materials like aluminum screen or cheesecloth or something called rug hold, which is something you put under your rugs to keep them from sliding around. And they're assembled in a collage-like way, many layers from support structures that I build from wood. Some of them are freestanding and some of them hang from the wall. And I think a lot of people think of them in terms of textile or in fabric, but it's really all paint on or on something.
Yeah.
Other material.
Why the connection? Why the interest in the textile sort of
connection? Well, I look at a lot of decorative arts, and of course fabrics and quilts in particular fall into that category. And I'm very interested in crafts that are of the hand and that are very labor intensive.
Uh-huh.
And so there's that reference there. I'm pretty much an abstract painter. And I work with a lot of repetitive patterning and marking systems and high key color, and so there's a natural kind of crossover affinity.
Why you haven't ever gotten into textiles? I mean, if quilts and things are...
I don't know why I've never made a quilt. Partly, I think with textiles and patterning and textiles, there is a motif that really does repeat itself.
Right.
And you can find that. You can deconstruct it and say, well, here's the motif. And that would be in a quilt or in something that's mass produced for, you know, consumption in terms of fabric. But in my work, there really is no repeat that you can actually isolate. It implies that, and so it keeps your eye looking for it and keeps you investigating it, but it actually will never repeat itself.
Okay. Well, you've said some interesting things in your artist statement. Technology, consumerism, the media, and global events have completely redefined the way we experience the world.
Right. And
I think we've only got 30 minutes
A really good thing, and, you know, and it allows us to do tremendous things that we weren't able to do before. A lot of it has come into our lives. But it also has some side effects that I think are kind of troublesome, and some of that is that it just, because we have so much we can access, we almost have to put blinders on, or we have to skim or mm-hmm. scan, and so we're really not looking as critically or as concentratedly. We're just not focusing, really, I think. And I think that
multitasking,
itself,
I think, is
we're trying
the
to
buzzword.
Do too many things
right.
at one time.
Right. Which apparently brain research is now saying doesn't work, but anyway.
Right.
Good luck multitasking.
And I'm still going to do it. But
guess,
you know,
guess why you have your hand caught in your printer, you know?
But I think there's something to be said to find a way to focus you and to quiet your mind. And while I use the circle as a motif quite a bit in my work, and one of the reasons I use it is to reference binary code of zeros and ones, to kind of reference that repetition.
That technology. I can't imagine anybody doesn't know that computers are set up on a binary code of zero and ones, but
if
they didn't, now they do.
Okay. And I've tried to make my work really visually complex so that it does make you slow down and investigate it over a longer period of time. And hopefully that will kind of create a quiet zone or a respite kind of space for you to maybe even think about something else other than the art. But, you
right.
know, to help you kind of center yourself. So I see my work kind of functioning in that.
So do you find yourself struggling with that incredibly fast-paced world that we're all forced to live in, and you're saying that in some ways in the arts that has invaded the arts also, and
I think
made
it definitely
and made
has
the,
invaded the arts, and everything is much more accelerated. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you literally can be. You know, I mean, you know, when they were talking about being famous for 15 minutes,
right.
it was kind of a joke at the time. But now you really can be
now
famous
you're only
for
famous for five.
No, you're right, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, I've never been kind of motivated in that way to the consumer side of things. Maybe I should be. I don't know. But I've always made the work for other reasons. And for me, I'm really think many people are in. Looking for some way to kind of step out of that pace. And many artists are returning to very labor-intensive processes and
right.
marking systems. And my work is very slow and labored in some ways.
So are you saying you're reacting to the capitalist pressure that comes with the arts? That, you know, I mean, everybody I've ever known has been successful ends up being a machine. I mean, they've
right.
got a gallery who's saying, I need to make some more art, make some more, you know. But it sounds like you are responding very directly to that kind of pressure or that kind of movement.
Well, I mean, I would love to sell the work and have someone live with it,
right.
you know, in their personal environments or have it in mm-hmm. a nice in a good, solid collection. And, you know, I'm not trying to subvert that system because I have the opportunity to teach. I'm not forced to try and make my living,
right.
you know, from
right.
the sales of my work. I think it would be really difficult if I was. So, like I said, my motivations.
Does that free you up?
Well, in some ways it does free me up because, you know, I can pursue what I think I need to pursue rather than what someone expects me to produce.
Right.
And, you know, I pretty much have gone my path, you know, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. my to my success or not, I'm not sure, but
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Well, that's interesting because I mean, it's obviously something that you seem very comfortable with. Some artists I talk to are very comfortable with it. Some of them have sort of gone their own paths and have, you know, just sort of been successful. I mean, it's so much. The art world is sort of like the theater world or the movie world. You know, there's so many people involved and so few ever breakthrough commercially.
Mm-hmm.
So what keeps you going? I mean, it obviously is not a commercial process for you. This
okay.
is not, your self-esteem is not based on how many pieces you've sold or not sold.
Right.
Your, obviously you said you teach, so you have an income from that. So what does drive you? What keeps you coming into the studio?
Well, partly it's just, you know, a sort of inner desire to make beautiful things. Mm-hmm. And it does give me a lot of satisfaction to actually work with the materials and end up with paintings, right, or drawings or works on paper.
Uh-huh.
I have always been motivated to show it, and so, you know, and to share it and have an audience,
right,
interact with it. And I do feel somewhat of a, you know, that I have somewhat of a mission to, like, get the work out there.
Uh-huh.
So that, you know, maybe a non-artist,
right,
could actually, you know, have some sort of insights or enter into that creative process and that dialogue by kind of deciphering the work that I make.
But the process really for you is more just about the creative process.
Yes.
Just living in that, inhabiting that, experiencing that. How's that different from your daily world? Is there...
Well, it's a lot slower.
Is it?
Yeah. And then you can be in your own sort of mind frame. I mean, you, uh-huh, can really disengage from the rat race. Sounds,
right,
kind of cliche, but...
No, not at all.
Sets up a private zone, you know,
uh-huh,
and I'm hoping that my work will set up that private space within a public space for the audience as well.
For someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's interesting. You also have said, to cope with the flood of infinite information, we sacrifice subtlety by developing scanning strategies to decode our daily encounters. To counter these tactics, my artwork strives to slow the viewer down, which we were just talking about, to reacquaint the viewer with his or her visual sense, and to assert the reward of contemplation and concentrated visual exploration. I mean, we just sort of talked about that, but, mm-hmm, do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Well, I think people are really looking for something to give meaning to their lives, and they can find it in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And some think there has been a resurgence of people going to museums looking for, you know, that kind of experience that they're not finding in other places. And so,
mm-hmm,
I mean, I think about that and want to create that kind of space with my work for,
right,
someone to allow them to slow down, to center themselves, to, you know, kind of have a creative response to a creative piece.
Yeah.
It's kind of an aesthetic response, but...
Is there a religious overtone here?
I think there could be a sense of having something transcend, you know, where you are and allowing, mm-hmm, you to kind of make a step into another plane of thinking. And Rothko is a, you know, the artist Rothko,
right,
and that's what his work was all about. And I've looked at that work and have experienced that work more,
uh-huh,
than just looking at it, and have felt that in the presence of his work, and would hope that a similar kind of...
Felt that sense of transcendence, of,
right,
moving into a house. Can you, maybe,
well, it's,
I don't
really
know,
difficult
even,
to describe.
Yeah.
It really takes a long, it takes time.
I mean, I hope everybody who's listening knows Rothko, but, you know.
Well, Rothko's paintings are large,
yeah,
fields of color. They're usually floating rectangles that,
mm-hmm,
kind of hover in a colored space. And if you have the opportunity to view a number of Rothkos in a space together, which is how they were designed to be installed, and you go and you sit within that space for an extended period of time, the paintings actually start to animate themselves, and you actually become part of the installation.
They animate themselves. What does that mean?
Well,
that's,
they start to move and communicate.
Really?
You actually start to see them vibrate.
Really?
It's kind of a visual vibration,
uh-huh,
through color interactions and things, but they, they're very active. And you, but you,
uh-huh,
have to actually place yourself in that situation for an extended, well, maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes,
mm-hmm,
so that you can, like, turn off your own,
mm-hmm,
filters and just sort of allow it to actually stimulate you in a visual way. And most people don't give painting that much time.
No.
And so...
Nor do they understand...
That they should.
That they should, right.
Yeah, they're,
yeah,
scanning.
Right.
And then 3 minutes, oh, I don't like that, or,
right,
or I do like that, but...
Or I don't get it.
Oh, yeah, it's like... Or
I was going
to... do that.
I was going to... That's what I was going to call this show.
My dog could do it.
I could do that.
Right. So...
How do you answer someone when they say that?
Well, I answered them by saying...
I mean, if they look at a Rothko, which, you know, on the surface looks simple,
mm-hmm,
because you really are, it's almost, like, this is the wrong word, but so, in a sense, a rainbow of colors.
Some of them can sort of,
you look at it and you go, well, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, so there's, you know.
Well, I think that what I talk about oftentimes is that abstraction is a language, is a visual language. And if you've never, you know, learned the language, it's no different than not understanding someone speaking French.
Right.
If you don't know how to speak French.
Okay.
So,
so it helps to bring something to it.
Well, everyone brings something to it, but it's, right. it helps to recognize the fact that it does have a language of its own and mm-hmm. that you can learn it. And what I do with my work, I try to put prompts in the work that will like stimulate a memory or some kind of trigger reference for almost anyone. And that kind of opens the door a little bit. And they say, well, I understand that. I recognize that. And then you kind of hook them with that. And then if you can get them to spend some time
like investigating. What would you put in your work that would do that?
Well, the references, I use a lot of motif kind of references to different things. And more recently, they're becoming more specific. The circle can be a very universal symbol, but and just as the circle, but it can also be found in almost every culture, and how they, you know, use things that are intertwining, or in you know, when I had the opportunity to be in Paris for 7 weeks, I really was looking for every circular motif I could find, and so then I come back and I use those motifs kind of as research drawings that then find their way into the paintings.
When you say motif, what do you mean by that?
Well, a motif is something that repeats, and so but it's also something that's very recognizable and almost symbolic and metaphorical. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in Notre Dame, there were circle patterns and very decorative ones in the windows everywhere.
Yeah,
in the glass windows everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I drew them when I was there, and then I made little paintings of them, and now the paintings are becoming absorbed into the bigger paintings. So if you spend time with the work, you actually can kind of discover these sort of embedded layers of information.
Okay, and just one last thing before we start talking about some of the projects you've done, some of the curatorial work you've done. You also have said that as organized chaos, my art offers a visual respite as an alternative to the fragmentation fostered by our culture.
Right.
We've been
kind of talking about that.
Yeah.
So we do live in a very chaotic visual world. And so my work is really combinations of many systems. And I guess the best way to describe it would be if you think about collage. And collage is where you combine lots of different materials and then it becomes one made up of several different types of things combined. So what I do is I start with large paintings that I generate either very process-based and kind of very mixed-media poured things. And I tend to make 3 to 6 large paintings that tie together through color, and then they're torn up and then recombined in a new sort of
system. Are you working on paper?
No, I'm working on canvas.
You're working on canvas?
Primarily. I'll start with a 6x9 foot canvas.
Uh-huh.
And I paint on both sides of everything so I can flip things if I
need
to. So I always start with at least one that's very organic and fluid, and then I'll generate another painting that's more structural and repetitious based on a grid and a more patterned marking system.
Right.
And then I'll generate one that's usually a combination of the two. And so then I'll have like these 3 to 6 large paintings, if you will, that all sort of make sense together coloristically, and then they get torn down into strips, and there's these strips that get recombined.
Are they torn into strips, or are they torn into...
They're torn into large
strips,
basically,
okay.
And then they're recombined into with other materials, and that's when I bring in the aluminum screen or the cheesecloth or the rug hold, which is also painted on and marked up, and they become these really large sort of three-dimensional collages.
Huh, interesting. So organized chaos, huh?
So it's like I'm sort of, it's organized, but it's also very, there's a lot of shifting going on.
Well, let's talk about, because you're also a curator, besides being a professor and obviously a very good professor, judging by the award you just received for that, an artist, and sort of a project organizer, and one of the more recent ones, I guess, is the Diva and Iron Chefs of Encaustic. You want to talk about that a little bit? I like the name.
Yeah, it's a great name. The Divas and the Iron Chefs of Encaustic is a group of 8 artists that I curated, and they're from a large geographic area, as far away as Canada, Georgia, the Midwest, Mid-Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And the encaustic, for those who may not know what it is basically working with molten wax that has pigment in it, so you can paint with it while it's heated and liquefied at that point, and then it dries very quickly through the air. The air cools mm-hmm. it. So it's a very sort of labor-intensive process, which appeals to me, and it's a very beautiful, seductive material to work with. And my interest in encaustic goes back many years, and I decided it would be fun and challenging to organize a traveling exhibition of encaustic that featured encaustic as the mm-hmm. themed ingredient. So the mm-hmm. title is to conjure kind of expert artists or chefs, you know, like the top chefs. And encaustic, of course, is the main event. And it's been traveling for a year, and it's currently at the McLean Center for the Arts, mm-hmm. and it will come down to the Anderson Gallery in the fall.
Mm. Yeah, because encaustic, for those who don't know, is really an ancient art form.
Yes,
it died out for a long time, and then was rediscovered.
Goes back to the ancient mummies uh-huh. portraits, and right. they were discovered in the Nile Delta region. Mm-hmm. And the process really hasn't changed all that much over the years, except that electricity has made it very much more easily.
You have to build a fire to melt the beeswax.
Yeah, you had
right.
to build a fire and
right.
heat your tools in the flame.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. What about Constructs? That's another project that you've been working on.
Well, Constructs is a group of Virginia and D.C.-based artists, and here its primary focus is abstraction, actually, and abstraction that artists have arrived at through a sort of constructed sensibility. So many of the artists physically construct their paintings from multiple parts. Some of them construct it conceptually from multiple angles. And so it's actually quite a beautiful show that it's highly colored, and the focus is color, I think. And it's been traveling as well around the region.
Mm-hmm.
And it recently received a Virginia Project Grant, Virginia Commission for the Arts Project Grant, if I say it right, to produce a catalog for it, which is
wonderful.
Going to be great. So
yeah.
It's going to travel, I think, for a few more years. It's a very dynamic group of artists.
Yeah. Well, how does that take place? I mean, where does the money come for something like that?
Well, of course, we apply for grants, mm-hmm. And sometimes we get them. The Virginia Commonwealth University School of the Arts and the Painting and Printmaking Department has been very supportive of the projects that I've been working on recently.
Yeah.
And so they have given us money to do some of the catalogs and to bring some of the artists mm-hmm. to campus and things like that. So I'm very grateful for the support that we get from the school.
What other ones have you done? Because you've done others than these two, than Constructs and the Divas and Iron Chefs.
Right. Well, I did another traveling. They've all been traveling shows.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is
that's
really
interesting.
To try and facilitate. But Pivot Points was another one that was a group of teachers and students. So we highlighted 3 generations of painters and poets, actually.
Right, interesting.
That... and you saw the relationship between each of the generations, between the previous generation, and sometimes even between the third generation and the first generation.
How did you see that relationship? What do you mean?
Well, I think that as a teacher, you hope you make an impact on your students, mm-hmm. but you're not always sure
yeah.
where that happens. And, you know, you hope your students will keep in touch with you. So some of it was very obvious, I think, in terms of the visual dynamics that you saw played out over the generations. And some of it was more... you know, conceptual, and what I found really fascinating was how much actually crossover there was between the poetry and the paintings. And
yeah, talk about that. So you have poetry with paintings.
We did, and
which chicken or egg came first? I mean,
well,
how does that?
The painting idea came first, and then Sally Bowring, who was the coordinator.
Oh, I know her.
Yes, your lovely wife, the co-coordinator of the project with me, she was inspired to add the poetry angle, which which I thought was a great idea. So we contacted some friends, and they basically set up sort of a tandem structure of three generations of poets that mirrored the structure we had already set up with
So when you say three generations, you're talking about teacher, student, teacher, student.
Student teacher. And then
yeah,
the, right.
Okay, interesting.
And the paintings
so these people
were not
have all had
in
contact
reaction to the poetry, and the poetry was not written in reaction to the paintings.
It was not, okay.
They were two separate structures of teachers and students. But what I found fascinating was how much similarity there really was and how well it meshed across the two disciplines.
What kind of similarities? That's really interesting. I mean, because they were not, because your assumption would be that the poets would look at the paintings and have some sort of reaction and write something about it, but you said they didn't do that.
No, they were all done independently. So I think where it came out most clearly to me was when we were actually in group discussions, and some of the poets and some of the painters were present. And the poets would describe their work very visually.
Interesting.
And the painters would describe their work very poetically.
Very verbally.
Yeah. So it like just flipped on itself.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it was,
that's fascinating.
It was really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I've only interviewed a couple of poets. And I'm trying to think, you know, whether or not, because people would say to me, so you're going to do a radio show and you're going to talk to visual artists? And I've had someone who actually does a wonderful job interviewing authors. And she said, I tried to interview visual artists. She said, after 5 minutes, it was like, what do you talk about? And I said, well, you know, they're thinking about a lot of stuff as they're doing this. We're not just like, well, there's red and then there's blue and, you know, and some abstraction in colors. I said, there really is a whole nother life going on. Inside of that this is really just sort of the tip. Would you agree? Sort of the tip of the iceberg in terms of the process for you? The actual finished product?
Right. I think most artists probably are more invested in the process than they are in the finished product.
Yeah.
At least I am. I'm very happy when the finished product, you know, does what I hope it will do.
Right.
But it doesn't stop me from starting over or, you know, reinvesting or designing something from a new angle. It's all about exploration, you know, trying to find something new for yourself. You know, you want to stay interested and invested. And you don't want to make the same painting over and over again 100
right.
times.
I mean, but, yeah, exactly. I mean, this is sort of a journey, yes?
That's how I think of it, as a journey. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love that analogy, that metaphor.
Okay. Guess what?
We're finished.
Thank you. You were wonderful. I know it is always so challenging to try and squeeze an entire life of thinking and making and teaching and painting and projects into 30 minutes, but I think you did a great job. So thank you, Rennie Gower, for talking with us today. And thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you for lunch again on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.